support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, dedicated to a healthcare system that works for all Californians, on the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, serving Central California from Bakersfield to Merced, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, a special two-hour election preview. We'll look at the 17 ballot measures going before voters. We'll also talk to two of the candidates who want to be your next mayor, in Fresno, Henry Perea, and in Bakersfield, Karen Goh. Next week, we'll hear from the other candidates in the race, including Lee Brand and Kyle Carter. We'll also learn how Fresno is kicking off a new vision for community parks as well. Right now, though, we begin our program out in the far western reaches of Fresno County, Coalinga. In a few weeks, California voters will be asked to weigh in on legalizing recreational marijuana. Medical marijuana is already legal in the state. And as FM 89's Ezra David Romero reports, one Central California city is looking at how it can cash in on this green revolution.
Patrick Keough wanted out of Coalinga about 5 years ago. The 18,000 people or so that call this town in the hills of the Coastal Range home couldn't support his realty company.
I told my wife, I want to leave. I want more opportunity for us. And she said, well, I love my job. I said, well, if we're going to stay, we have to get involved in city government, and we have to make something for our children to have hope.
He ended up winning a spot on the Coalinga City Council in 2012. Speed up to last December. The 44-year-old is now the mayor pro tem, and the city is facing yet another problem. It's in the red. That's when Keough had an epiphany while sitting in front of an abandoned prison owned by the city. It had been run by a private company until Governor Jerry Brown closed it in 2011.
And I would look and I would think to myself, what can I put here? What can we do? It hit me. This could be a medical marijuana facility.
He ran with the idea, and in January, the city council unanimously voted to allow commercial cultivation, delivery, distribution in the city, and directed staff to begin the ordinance process. In July, the city passed a temporary ordinance so companies could come to Coalinga, look at land, and even buy it if they want to. The city is working on a permanent ordinance. That opened the door for Keough to find a suitor for the vacant 77,000-square-foot Claremont Custody Center on the edge of town. The facility used to hold around 500 prisoners. Now it's empty, but it could be a moneymaker for the city.
What you're seeing right now is where the employees would enter. The little command center would have had all the keys.
The prison is sort of the perfect place for marijuana cultivation. It's protected by a chain-link fence with spirals of razor wire on top.
Let's go down there. You want to go in? Let's go in.
Inside are two large courtyards, double dining rooms, a kitchen, laundry facilities, and six dormitories.
So we're going into the west side pod where the prisoners would have been housed.
The pod looks as if the prisoners recently moved out.
Over on that wall, you could see where the pay phones would have been, so if they would have earned the privilege of having a call.
Keough points to the underside of a bunk.
What does it say?
Well,
there's some girls.
Graffiti, and there's pictures of girls, and there's a picture of a truck.
Keough searched for months for the perfect buyer. The city finally decided to go with a Southern California-based company, Ocean Grown Extracts, for a grand total of about $4.1 million. Keough says that amount alone will pay off $3.5 million of city debt. The deal is getting even more press because the company announced that reggae artist Damian Marley is their partner.
The benefits go beyond just getting high, if that's what you want to call it. It's proving for itself the more people experience it and get involved and get exposed to it, that's useful.
If everything goes as planned, the company will sell cannabis oil made in Coalinga, wholesale to dispensaries. Marley says the first marijuana crop will be ready to harvest by January.
In general, it's a time of pioneering, though, you know, because it's all this kind of business is new. The laws keep on changing. So this is really a new frontier for everyone involved.
There are clear benefits for the city. Ocean Grown Extracts says it will employ around 100 people and promises to pay $2 million to the city in lease and tax payments yearly. But not everyone in the community is so keen on the idea. Arthur Douglas has lived in Kalinga since the 50s. He's not sure about the deal and says he has some reservations.
I have no problems with the dispensary in Kalinga so people can get their medicine. My problem is with the doctors that are doling out medical marijuana cards. If a kid sneezes and he's 18 years old, he can get a medical marijuana card. I don't agree with that.
Others like cattle rancher Greg Cody support the project and hope the proposition on the November ballot legalizing recreational marijuana use passes.
I think we need to think outside the box and continue to move forward with this. You know, most people didn't have a problem with prisoners being here. You're not going to see those plants, and those plants aren't going to go out and hurt anybody.
Back at the prison, Patrick Keogh is hopeful that Kalinga is set for the future.
You're in the hallway. Prisoners would be here. There's various rooms for classrooms.
His term on the council ends in December, and he says the city is courting 12 other cannabis-related companies.
You go to our Starbucks, you see people who are not from town, you see them wearing suits. You know these are business people. You know these are people with money, innovation, ideas, and they're all coming to our town.
But until the city council votes on a permanent ordinance in November, and then escrow closes, the facility stands vacant, and dreams of revamping this town are on hold. With Valley Public Radio News, I'm Ezra David Romero.
The last time the city of Fresno re-examined its strategy behind building and maintaining public parks, Ronald Reagan was president. Some say it shows. The Trust for Public Land recently ranked Fresno 97th out of 100 in the nation when it comes to public access to city parks. Now, after much community complaint, work is finally underway to bring city parks into the 21st century. Valley Public Radio's Jeffrey Hess reports from one of the first public meetings in the process of crafting a new vision for green space and explains why a plan is only part of the fix.
Standing beneath a giant sign showing where every park in the city is located, 14-year-old Mia Burrell lays out what she considers to be the biggest problem with Fresno's park system in stark terms.
If I were like a little young kid, I wouldn't really want to play in a park. It's just, there's a lot of, like, especially drugs out there. And they used to have, like, the needles and stuff, like laying around and, like, smelled like weed all the time. So it's really not, like, a good place to play around.
Mia's father, Richard, says he has 7 kids in total and is just as blunt in his assessment about why he's often reluctant to take his kids to parks where they see people he believes are homeless or prostitutes.
Along with, like, various drug paraphernalia, whether it be meth pipes, syringes, and dope cookers and all this stuff. Used condoms, feces on the slides and stuff like that.
What they say they want is more and safer parks with indoor facilities that parents and kids can feel secure in. Dozens of people mill around the cafeteria of the school, writing down suggestions on large sheets of paper and talking with city leaders and representatives from the San Francisco-based consulting firm Wallace Roberts Todd, which is taking the lead on crafting what is called the Parks Master Plan. Community meetings like this one are just the beginning of the work to design a new vision for parks in Fresno. John Gibbs is with the consulting firm WRT.
There's a lot of needs, there's a lot of challenges and things to overcome. We have inequity in distribution of the right kinds of amenities. Half the population of Fresno is not in walking distance of a park.
On top of that, Gibbs says some of the parks have attracted exactly the kind of activities Mia and Richard Burrell complain about.
There's other challenges related to what you find when you get to a park, whether it's full of folks that are doing something that's counter to a civic park, whether it's sleeping or it's other illicit activities. You know, that's preventing people from using the parks we have.
WRT specializes in urban design. He says the thinking around urban parks has changed a lot in the last 30 years, leaving the existing parks plan out of date. For example, it's not enough to simply clear some space and put up a bench. Gibbs says you need to provide programming to bring in a critical mass of people who use the park for its intended purpose. And to do that, you have to consider the design aesthetic of the park and its buildings.
I think there's a lot of parks that we've come into that people don't respect because they're just not engaging. And, you know, this is really fundamental. This isn't, you know, rocket science and stuff where, you know, we went off to the mountain and to the Oracle and spoke and came back and said, you just need to make your parks beautiful. I think that that's a really basic and important thing.
That's something that's of serious interest for Brandon Taylor, who's the father of three young children. He also has concerns about safety, but sees a chicken and egg situation. How do you get people to go to the park and make it safer if people already think the parks aren't safe?
You kind of think of it as a house that's just been sitting dormant for a year, 2 years. You're going to get individuals who go into that house that aren't supposed to be there, per se. So if we can bring programming into the park space, we'll see that it's utilized. It'll get utilized more, hopefully, but that there's a purpose to the green space rather than just having green space.
Lastly, Gibbs says building more park space has a side benefit for people who don't use the parks because more green space can help lower the temperatures of the valley's sweltering summers. He even thinks that improving energy efficiency at existing parks could help free up money for improvements and expansion. And money's where the big sticking point is. According to the city, it cost about $500,000 for the construction of a park with even simple amenities. So to build a new 5-acre park would run the city close to $2.5 million. And that doesn't even factor in the ongoing cost of park maintenance, like cutting and watering the grass and keeping the parks secure and paying for programming that residents say they want and consultants say they need. That greatly complicates making a master plan when you don't know how much you have to spend. It's likely to be one of the major priorities facing the next Fresno mayoral administration. So while most at the meeting, public advocacy groups, and city leadership seem to agree that there's a serious need for more parks, the green that ends up keeping that from happening could be the color of money. For Valley Public Radio News, I'm Jeffrey Hess.
You're listening to a special election preview edition of Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Later on in our program in the next hour, we'll go through the ballot measures going before voters in November. There's 17 of them. Fresno State Professor Thomas Holyoke will join us to talk about why they matter and what some of the nuances behind the arguments are. We'll also talk with Bakersfield mayoral candidate Karen Goh. She's hoping to become the next mayor of Kern County's largest city. She's squaring off against Kyle Carter, who we hope to hear from next week. Right now, though, we turn our attention to the Fresno mayor's race. It's probably the most closely watched Central Valley contest, aside from the 21st Congressional District. In it, you have a current city council member in Lee Brand, squaring off against a former city council member and current member of the Fresno County Board of Supervisors, Henry R. Perea. A few days ago, I had a chance to sit down with Perea for an in-depth, hard-hitting conversation about the issues. Here's what he had to say. Henry, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
I want to look at some issues we haven't talked about in our previous interviews on Valley Public Radio.
Okay.
I want to start out with parks. The city is right now in the midst of this new parks master plan, yet current city hall officials say they don't have an idea yet of how to fund more parks, both construction and operations. Given that they don't really have a budget or scope in mind at this point, how would you go about crafting a plan and make sure that it can actually be one that's implemented and not one that sits on the shelf and gathers dust?
Well, I mean, I'm certainly going to support and allow the process to move through in terms of determining, you know, what that master plan at the end is going to look like and what it's going to be. But of course, it's going to be critical. Whatever that may be, is then how are you going to fund it? I can tell you, I think the backbone of a plan has to be what you have in your inventory now. And what we know is that a lot of the parks are in disrepair. And there was a lot of, you know, a lot of reasons for that. Economic times were tough. But I think the next mayor has to make that a priority. You know, the economics are better for the city of Fresno, like for a lot of the government entities. But I think the first priority as we're working through that master plan is fix what you have. So I think the city needs to immediately invest in its parks and upgrade them, you know, fix the things that are broken. But I also think the city has to move towards the model of staffing its own parks. I think the model of asking the community to engage, which I think is always a great thing to involve your community, but I don't think it's working. And I think you need to have dedicated staff that are at those city parks that are helping to manage them, but also outreach into the community. And that's part of the model I'm going to use to hire high school students, college students, to be a part of those rec leaders that we had many, many years ago when I was young. I remember those days. And I think it creates that opportunity where then people buy into their neighborhoods. You know, it gives them money to spend. And I think it connects the soft skills that they need to learn in employment, just things they need to learn. So, I mean, I think that's the first thing we need to do. Long term, I think depending what comes out of that master plan, there's no question that we need more parks in this city. And we're going to, I think, have a very straightforward discussion with the public as to what is important to them. Because I know a lot of groups that we've talked to, there's people that want more trails and bikeways on the river. You know, there's people want more public safety. There's people who want more parks. There's the arts community that wants more money for arts. So, I mean, there's a major discussion coming in this community, and that's okay. That's healthy. I think it's good to have those discussions, put them in the right framework, and let people decide what they want to pay for.
One of the first issues with parks that could come across your desk if elected would be this land the city got on Peach Avenue in southeast Fresno, 50 acres. They got it from the government, federal government, years ago. Haven't really done anything with it. There's a community garden there. There's a group that wants the city to hand that over or either hand it back to the government or hand it over to them so that they can do their own park space there. Given that there's this parks master plan going, what would you support doing with that land right now? Giving it back to the government, waiting to determine what the plan is and the city maintaining control of it, or handing it over to this other independent group?
Yeah, I think right now we wait until we see what the master plan rolls out. But, I mean, I'd be shocked if in that master plan, at the end of the day, that large piece of land wasn't in that plan. I think the opportunity that we have today is that, one, we have the land. The federal government has designated it to be a park, and we've accepted it on those terms. But, recently Governor Brown was in Fresno, signed a cap and trade that was going to bring $70 million to this community. And the 93706 and 93702 zip codes pretty much brought us to that dance. You know, this was money based on poverty areas. And unfortunately, those areas are they need a lot of resources. So in my mind as a mayor, even though I think there are some folks at City Hall that have kind of already spent that money, I think you need to have a public process. You have to be fair for those who brought you to the dance, which is 93702 and 06, I think we have to have a very honest discussion with them about how we allocate some of those monies into those communities. And I think that particular park would be great for that area. And I think that money would be an appropriate use for that park. So now, I'm not saying all of it, but certainly its fair share of it.
Your opponent on that very issue says he wants to see that money go into the downtown projects and things right around the high-speed rail station. You're a big backer of high-speed rail. There's a lot of infrastructure that still is yet to be put in or replaced to accommodate that. Lee says that he can get a bigger bang for his buck, for the city's buck, by investing in that area and attracting other investment, private investment. Where is he wrong on that?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you where he's wrong, okay? Because first, let me just say, I am a very strong supporter of high-speed rail, and I think some of that money should go into that area as an investment. But I think where he's wrong is where I think City Hall has been maybe not as strong as they could have been the past 8 years, and that is they've been weak in public outreach. And I think this is a good example of that. Here you have $70 million that really has been awarded to this community because of the social economic issues that we have in some of the most impoverished areas of our city, which is Southwest Fresno and Southeast. So now we receive $70 million, and without talking to those communities, in some people's minds at City Hall, that money has already been allocated. Okay, so as great as it would be to spend all or a portion of that money downtown on the Fulton Mall around that high-speed rail station, which I think some should, the way I operate is from a position of community outreach. I mean, I want to hear what the community has to say. I want them to be partners with us in how we spend that money because there's more potentially coming. We need the people engaged and involved in that decision-making process. So I think that's where we differ on how that money would be spent. It's how we include and involve the public in the decision-making.
One of the other issues that's been a big talking point, a big focus, not only of this campaign, but also of City Hall and the local media over the last year, has been this issue of slumlord housing. This is a problem, though, that does not stop at the Fresno city limits. It is a problem throughout Central California, in rural areas, in dense urban centers, all over our listening area, Bakersfield and beyond.
what have you done as a member of the Board of Supervisors and, for that matter, during your term in the City Council to take on this issue overall?
Well, I mean, I'll start when I was on the City Council. That was a major issue to us then, and as a reaction to that being an issue, our City Council doubled our court enforcement unit at the time, and we created new policies that allowed our officers to go out and be very aggressive in dealing with slumlords. You know, recognizing that it's probably not a problem that's going to be solved 100% because there will always be bad actors out there. But we were very focused on reducing and minimizing those bad actors, because when you have a slumlord, it not only affects the quality of life for the person living in that unit, it affects the neighborhood. And sometimes that's what slumlords count on. They count on the working class folks in a neighborhood getting tired and frustrated with that one bad unit that's bringing down the area. Then they move. And what happens next? Well, the slumlord then buys that house, and it just perpetuates the problem. So it is a major quality of life issue for Fresno and Fresno County. Now, as a supervisor, I represent some of the poorest areas in this county. You know, when you go into the Mayfair area, the Cowboy area, you know, we have issues there. And we've been as aggressive as we can with them. But our unit at the county is much, much smaller than what we had at the city of Fresno. And I think that's one of the challenges and the opportunities, though, that I see as a mayor, because a mayor who controls resources can have a greater impact than when you're one of five people or one of seven people trying to allocate resources to so many different things. You can bring more continuity as a mayor. So, you know, I think as a supervisor, you know, could the county do more in dealing with some of those? Absolutely. But it's getting to that sweet spot where you get three people saying, hey, yeah, let's beef up our code enforcement unit to X to get things done. So right now what we have, like a lot of agencies, we have a complaint-based code enforcement operation. When somebody calls with a problem, we'll deal with it. And we are very aggressive in doing that. And we've cleaned up a lot of areas in my district. But, I mean, there's a lot of work to do. And I think from a city perspective, I know that the quality of life is going to be big, making Fresno an all-America city again. I think that's a good visual for people to put in their heads, because when you talk about that, you're talking about a safer community, a cleaner community, a community that's going to deal with slumlords, it's going to have clean freeways. I mean, it's a major mind shift that I see occurring at City Hall, and slumlords are going to be a big part of that, because I think that they are a blight on this community, and we're going to deal with them.
Affordable housing, though, is even a bigger issue. There's a lot of social justice organizations out there, the Obama administration, even some at City Hall now, who say that the way that cities like Fresno have taken on affordable housing over the years has been flawed. We've been concentrating affordable housing in one area of town. Fresno has huge issues of concentrated poverty, economic segregation, so to speak. Do you think that the city should do more to spread out its investment in affordable housing and low-income housing throughout the city so that all parts of town have affordable housing options?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the current general plan is going to provide that opportunity, and I think we're seeing it already play out. I think the biggest challenge that I see in affordable housing is there aren't enough resources. And, you know, I'm going to go back to this cap and trade, this $70 million, which is why I think it's so important that that we have a true community discussion on this expenditure, because there is more coming. But just some of the things I'm hearing from people in Southeast and Southwest is not only that park in Southeast, but, for example, how about using some of that money for affordable housing and leveraging it in Southeast, Southwest Fresno, Central Fresno? I mean, there's a lot of discussion around that. So, between that and the housing funds that the city gets every year from the federal government, it's how do we leverage those dollars working with the housing authority and other entities to build as many units as we can, because we have a housing shortage. But I think as time progresses, we are going to see more affordable housing throughout this community. I mean, when you have an infill-driven general plan, there's only one place to grow, and that's from within.
When it comes to affordable housing, it's not just a housing issue. It's also transportation, people getting around town. The city's doing this BRT thing, but FACTS is a major issue right now for a lot of people who rely on it. And it's something that is a concern for many people, because the city right now is exploring basically reworking the way that FACTS, the traditional lines, operate. Essentially, this proposal that's out there, talked about it at City Council in September, essentially would reduce the number of routes that are out there to provide more regular service on the most popular lines. This comes at the same time that FACTS ridership has dropped from 17 million in 2010 to 11 million in 2015. What do you think in general of that sort of change, trying to rework the way that FACTS works and putting more regular service in some lines but less service in other areas? And what would you do to fix FACTS?
Yeah, well, you know, I think the bigger issue of public transportation is I think the philosophy in this country. I mean, this country is okay, and I agree with the philosophy of subsidization of freeways and highways and bridges 100% of taxpayer dollars, just like airports. I mean, people don't fly every day, but major subsidies of taxpayer dollars go into airports, and people are okay with that. But when it comes to public transportation, trains, buses, et cetera, then it becomes a subsidy. You know, it becomes something bad. So I hope one day at the national level there's this discussion that public transportation is just as worthy of the other things that we fund that move people around in this country. But when you bring it to the local level, I remember on my city council days in the late 90s, early 2000s. I mean, at that time, we had a bus system that was built to maybe truly service maybe half of the city efficiently. And of course, we have buses spread out all over the city, so we did a not too good job everywhere, you know. So, I mean, there's no question. I think there has to be a new discussion on public transportation with the resources that we do have, because I don't see a lot of new money coming in for buses. But I think we have to talk about the most used routes, and if maybe we do need to shift from maybe some parts of the city don't get bus service, you know, if the numbers just don't warrant it. But I also think we need to start thinking about smaller fleets. I think the bus is too big. You know, I think we have smaller buses. It may give us broader opportunity to expand service if we're just thinking about the way we're moving people around differently, because there's routes that are busy in the morning and maybe busy in the evening, but in between, they're not very busy. So why do we have these big buses running through the city? So I think everything needs to be on the table, and we need to figure out where is the highest need and where is the greatest opportunity to provide on-time service for folks and to provide them shelters. I mean, that drives me nuts when I go by a neighborhood when it's raining or it's hotter than heck and people are just standing out there, either no bench or a bench with no cover. We have to respect our customer a little more.
Wouldn't more buses, though, be more expensive? And you already have the big buses.
Well, we have the big buses. Of course, I wouldn't park them and not use them anymore. I think it's a long-term strategy. It starts transitioning. As you add more buses to the fleet, you start rethinking about what type of bus, what size of bus, and then, of course, attach them to the routes.
Do you think BRT has a chance of fulfilling its, you know, it's been really sold on this big, lofty plan that not only is it going to be a transportation solution for people who rely on the bus, the supporters, including the mayor, current mayor, say, A, it's going to get people who have a choice of taking their car to choose to take public transportation, and B, also stimulate all this new development, that we're going to have condos lining Blackstone, yeah, condos lining Ventura, Kings Canyon. Do you think it has the potential of living up to those dreams?
I don't think so. I don't. And, you know, I think I'll start with just the original BRT. I mean, I like BRT. I support the concept. I think it's good. But I think it went through so many political machinations to just get enough votes to make it happen. Because it was at one point in jeopardy of losing all that money. You know, what they approved was not true BRT. So it doesn't mean what we have isn't going to work, and we're going to make work the best we can. But I mean, just adding it as a part of our system and just looking at some of the upgrades that are created, we need those upgrades in this community anyway, so that's good. And I hope it does realize some of the potential that it was envisioned with in the beginning. But if people are thinking it's going to be the catalyst for, oh my God, we're going to see 60,000 high-rise units on Blackstone Avenue, that's just not going to happen. I'm not saying it's not going to happen someday, but I can go back to when I was on the city council and we approved a general plan that was infill driven. You know, at that time, the vision of the mayor was to move Fresno to the base of Friant Dam. In our council, there were four new of us that came in and we wanted an infill plan. And long story short, that's what we approved. But one of the cornerstones of our plan was 60,000 units on Blackstone Avenue. We thought, well, that's a great idea. Well, I look at now 2016, look back to when I approved a plan around 2000, there's not one unit. So I think as you mature in this type of job, you tie the reality that you add to a general plan is the economic reality, as well as how do people and where do people want to live. And just the economics of Blackstone. I mean, if you just took Manchester Center, you know, say from Shields to Dakota, and use that as a model and said, okay, what would it look like if we put, say, 5,000 units there? I mean, when you start doing the what planners and engineers do and talk about the infrastructure, what has to come out, what has to go in, and that before you can even start building, I mean, that number would be mind-boggling. So we have to be real and strategic about what we do and where we build and how we improve our world called Fresno.
Our guest is Fresno County Supervisor Henry Perea, running for mayor of Fresno. He's facing off against Lee Brand on the November ballot. Lee will join us on this program next week at this time. It's a special Valley Edition today, a two-hour program as we look at the election. We'll be back with more of Henry Perea in a bit. And remind you to stay tuned. In the second hour, we'll talk to Bakersfield mayoral candidate Karen Goh, and we'll go through the 17 ballot measures that are before voters in November. Stay with us. There's more to come here on Valley Edition.
During an election year, news coverage can start to sound the same. And that's where NPR comes in.
I'm Asma Khalid.
Domenico Montanaro.
Sam Sanders.
Scott Detrow.
Danielle Kurtzleben.
Carrie Johnson.
To tell stories about the election from all different angles.
I cover demographics and the campaign.
Political editor.
Campaign reporter.
Cover tech and politics.
Digital political reporter.
Justice correspondent.
We take you on a journey.
White House correspondent.
Through the issues.
And I cover Congress.
And inform you about the world as it changes. Listen every day.
Starting at 4 o'clock on Valley Public Radio.
My fellow students, my campaign supports more recess every day.
This fall, a lot of campaigns are making big promises.
And instead of math, we'll have video game class.
Only time will tell how many will be kept. But there is one campaign that will keep its promise, to bring you insightful news, enriching classical music and entertainment year-round. We call it Yes on 89. Valley Public Radio's fall membership campaign. We count on your support to keep public radio strong here in the Valley. And even after the votes are counted this fall, our reporters will be there to make sure your representatives do what they say.
If I'm elected student body president, we'll have pizza parties every Friday.
Vote yes on FM 89 today with your membership donation at kvpr.org.
I promise to abolish homework.
You're listening to a special two-hour Valley Edition election preview program. I'm Joe Moore. In our next hour, we'll talk to Bakersfield mayoral candidate Karen Goh and go through the 17 ballot measures before voters this fall. Right now, our guest in studio is Fresno County Supervisor Henry Perea, who is running for mayor of Fresno. Henry, back in 2008, the city and the county adopted a 10-year plan to end chronic homelessness. We're now 8 years into that plan. You were directly involved with creating it. By the looks of it on the street, it seems like there would be a lot of progress to go in the next 2 years to reach that goal. Do you think this plan is working? What's wrong with it? And what would you be open to changing it in some way?
Yeah. Well, you know, at the time I was on the county board of supervisors and was the point person from the county on that, just as Mayor Rocha was on the city. And when we did bring this plan together, I mean, it was a great event. But I think in our heart of hearts, we knew we would never end it. But I think it was certainly a vision to strive for. And as I look forward, I think between the city and the county and the housing authority and all the faith-based groups and, you know, folks that have worked on this issue, I think they've done a very good job with a very difficult population, you know, very challenging population. You know, I'm not quite sure if I'm there on the numbers that are out there, but, you know, you'll hear some folks say, well, we have taken care of 55% of the problem. You know, there's 55% less homeless than there were, you know, 10 years ago. But it doesn't feel that way. And it doesn't feel that way because I think strategically when the city around 2009 or so made the decision of hands off the homeless And then it created all those encampments in the downtown area. Then in 2013, when it just became critical mass, they said disperse them. And I think that's where we had a created a gap in the strategy and the plan, because the strategy of disbursement was dispersed with no plan. So that's why we have folks, you know, sleeping in the river bottom behind built vacant buildings in parks. I mean, they're everywhere. So I think people, the feeling of people are that the problem is getting worse, not getting better. But I think, as I've messaged before, you know, I know there's the folks that believe in housing first, which I think is a good model. There's the folks like the Rescue Mission and Parvarello that say, well, if you come through our doors, you're going to leave your drugs or alcohol outside, and you're going to, you know, accept some counseling here, et cetera. And some people don't want that. So then where do they go? Well, they go out into the streets. I think the gap are emergency shelters in this city, and I know there's some folks who support that and some who don't. But I think once, as a city, we can say here is an emergency shelter that will provide safe haven for folks at night, where we still have our workers that will help transition them to another service. I think then we start the other discussion of this committee of saying people aren't going to be sleeping anymore in the parks or behind buildings. You know, we're gonna move them into those shelters to, you know, keep them safe, try to get them to services, but also maintain the quality of life that people are asking for from every corner in this city. They're saying, hey, you know, we have kids, we have families in our neighborhoods, and we want safe, clean parks. You know, we want the same security everybody else has. And I agree with that. So I think once the city can look itself in the eye and its people in the eye, saying we have every available service within the resources that we have, I think people will hold hands with us and saying, okay, how do we, in a benevolent way, maintaining people's dignity, how do we move people off the streets into something else?
Homeless advocates like Mike Rhodes have made very powerful videos documenting the closure of those homeless camps, both in the Autry administration and in the Swearengen administration. If homeless camps reappeared in Fresno under your administration, would you close them down?
Yes. Yeah. And quite frankly, they would not grow to the size that they grew during those periods of time. To me, that was just complete neglect. I mean, it was just hands off, and that's not a solution. You know, I think once they start appearing, you immediately deal with them by getting the outreach teams out there to work with people to see if you can't get them into something else or, you know, a better service. And I know in my district as a county supervisor, that's the strategy we have, because they appear, you know, in the Cowell area, the Mayfair area, behind canal banks, and we hit it right away. You know, we go, we get our teams together, we go out, and it's not a law enforcement stance. It's how can we help you? These are the services. So it doesn't happen overnight. It does take us some time, but at some point we do have to get to, okay, but now here's the day, you can't be here anymore. And I'd like to honestly say that, well, once we disperse whatever was left of that encampment, that problem solved. No, it's not. I mean, whoever didn't go to service is going to go somewhere else. But then we go wherever they're at and keep talking to them, because at some point, the goal is to move people to a decision to get off the streets, to change their lives. And that's really the goal.
When you talk with Sheriff Mims or Chief Dyer, they both say Prop 47 has been a huge issue when it comes to crime and a rise in crime in the area. It redefined many drug and property crimes from felonies to misdemeanors. It was promoted as the Safe Neighborhoods and Schools Act. What do you think about this big push to reduce the prison population? You know, schools, not prisons. All these social justice organizations are behind this. Yet law enforcement is saying that this is driving up crime. Who's right here? Because there's a big dispute over really happening.
Yeah.
And how much of a problem do you see that is contributing to what's going on right now?
Well, I mean, it's one of those, I guess, coffee house discussions where everybody's right. You know, when I look at first, I'll start at the macro level. I mean, Governor Brown, his hands are handcuffed by the federal mandate that he has to reduce prison population. He has no choice. So when he started realignment, and then when Prop 47 passed, you know, one of the promises of Prop 47 is all these savings that we have, we're going to send back to the communities for the drug and alcohol rehab programs to, you know, to help. Well, as a county supervisor, I can tell you, it's not happening. Okay, and if it's happening, it's minimal. So the resources we need to now try to help people who are not going to jail or prison for services there, we don't have them. So they're released back onto the streets. So do I believe Prop 47 has created more law enforcement issues and safety issues in our community? The answer is yes, absolutely. I mean, I experienced it myself a year or two back. Somebody was breaking into my car as I was going to work, and I had to run out and stop them, you know. Yeah, it's a problem. You know, folks are out in the neighborhoods and they're, you know, when someone steals something and the law enforcement comes and all they're giving them is a citation and then they let them go right there on the spot. If you're the neighbor that just got robbed, you're like, what the heck? You know, he's still there. So there's a lot of imbalance in our society right now. But I bring it to the local level, just as I talked about, you know, I think in the whole public safety realm, there's just an imbalance that we have to bring back. I mean, yes, prison is not the solution. You know, warehousing people is not the solution. You know, all you do is, I think, you hone people's skills on committing crimes. You don't really do rehabilitation in prison. So what's the next best model? Well, the next best model is work with them. You know, try to work with them at the community level, give them services so they can transform their lives, you know, but we're not getting those resources back. And now we have another proposition coming.
I was just going to ask you about that, Prop 57.
And that's a problem. You know, I don't support that proposition for the very same reasons, because I've, as a county supervisor, I have seen the effects of well-intentioned laws like Prop 47 that is not bringing back the resources they promised us to help these people. And I think this next proposition is going to be just as bad.
I want to go back for a second now to this issue of the general plan and planning. You know, Mayor Swearengin has crafted this narrative out there that Fresno's problems are largely due to the way it grew over the last 40 or 50 years, that sprawl benefited developers, but it decimated older parts of town, bad planning or the lack of planning, whatever you want to call it. Do you agree with that assessment? Because it's somewhat controversial, and I don't think that we heard a mayor really articulate that before Swearengin.
Yeah, well, I think it's simplistic. You know, you always have challenges when a community grows, and you know, obviously there's a lot of economics tied to it. And I mean, I'm an inner city guy. I grew up in inner city. I'm still in the inner city. I think Mayor Swearengin lives in that part of town. She says it's sprawl. You know, so you know, I live and walk the walk. You know, so
Fresno High.
Yeah, I'm a Fresno High guy. You know, so. You know, no question it's a challenge. And when a community grows, just like when I was a kid and I rode bikes downtown. You know, that's where I went to school. You know, before there was a Freeway 41 and before there was a convention center. And all the kids in my school at St. John's Elementary School, there was Armenian town, German town, Italian town. That's where we grew up. You know, so I've seen a lot of change in this city. And then when Manchester Center was the big shopping center up north, and that's, you started seeing the decline of downtown. It's, you know, it happens in every community, and I think there's a lot of smart discussion going on now about, okay, well, how do you grow as a community without it being a detriment to your inner city? I mean, that's an ongoing discussion every day. But I think by stopping growth 100%, I don't think that's the winning combination. I mean, Fresno has an infill general plan now, which I'm going to support 100%. I have no interest, if I'm the mayor, to expand the city's boundaries. So I'm going to focus a lot on, well, whatever's left to build in Fresno. If somebody wants to build it, if it makes sense, then we'll build it.
Are there things you think you could fix with the general plan or with the development code? Or is there some room to work with it? Because you have criticized both of those.
Yeah. Well, I think really my only criticism is that right now, there's some elements of it they're trying to move through before the end of the year.
The downtown development code.
Downtown development code, et cetera. And I think, honestly, I don't think it's been vetted enough to get it to the point where it should be approved. And that's just not based on my observation on how government works, but also just people that I've talked to out in the community. People, but it's not fatal. I mean, if they pass it this year, that's fine. You know, I mean, things can always be tweaked, and it will be tweaked as issues come up. I think the issue more is when you talked about the parks plan, your first question, how do you start improving and dealing with the quality of life issues in your inner city so that, okay, if you are growing a community in southeast Fresno and in Sega, for example, if you go to the north, you know, rather west of 99 and build a community there, how can you not have it in a win-lose context? Say, well, oh gosh, here we're building again. Now it's going to hurt the inner city more. Well, no. I think you build any new neighborhood we build has to be self-sustaining, meaning that as a part of growing or living in that new neighborhood, you're going to be also paying for the future cost of replacing that street light, that broken sidewalk, et cetera. You know, it's kind of a pay-as-you-go, and I think that was part of the fault when you go back in time is as neighborhoods grew, we left the older neighborhoods behind. New parks were being built, but there were no revenue streams to come back and fix the inner city. So I think there's just a lot of balancing, rebalancing that we have to do in this city. But I think it's going to be a combination of us as government rethinking our resources, but also the community, because government can't do it all. You know, just neighborhoods I'm walking right now are like on this is a good example, the Fresno and Bullard area. I mean, that was North Fresno 20 years ago. And now you have those working families then at the time who moved into North Fresno. They're now 70, 80 years old. Their houses are paid off. They're retired. They can't move. But what I'm hearing every day at the door is, hey, don't forget us. You know, don't forget our neighborhoods. And you know what they're saying is, trim our tree. Fix that broken sidewalk. I mean, they're asking for the basics. They're not asking for the moon. So that's where I think the city can partner with this neighborhood. Okay, the other side of the coin is, okay, you be responsible in your neighborhood too. Work with your neighbors to make sure you're strong. So we're going to deal with the slumlord in their neighborhood. That's why it's so important to deal with slumlords, because that was probably the biggest issue that I, just this past weekend, I had talking with those folks in that area, is how they're seeing their neighborhood transition now. I mean, they love the younger families coming in because they're seeing kids and riding their bikes, but they're seeing more rentals. And they're okay with that too, except that you can pick out the rental that's the bad actor in the neighborhood. And that's why I think it's so critical to hold that slumlord accountable, because I think that's one of the biggest blights in this city. You know, they bring down a neighborhood faster than anything else. So a lot of moving pieces. But
when you have those inspections, you can inspect that, but then how do you follow up on that? The city is having huge problems right now holding Chris Henry accountable through its legal process. He's lawyered up.
Yeah.
This is the Somerset Village apartment
right.
owner who
right.
has this had this derelict property where people didn't have heat and natural gas last Thanksgiving around that time. Is it just as simple as having these inspections? Because right now it looks like you can have all sorts of fines and things issued, but is the follow-up there?
Yeah. Well, is it that simple? The answer is yes. But I think where that simplicity comes from is from a mayor who has a vision and who has the will to implement that vision. And I think that's what's been lacking at City Hall. And that's why at the end of the day, you see a Chris Henry playing games, or they get the citation and their fee is forgiven. No. You have a responsibility to your tenant and to that neighborhood. Once our code enforcement officers cite them and give them the appropriate time frames to fix their problem, that's great, fix it. But if there's a fine attached to it, we're not going to play games with them. They're going to pay it. They have to understand that if they're going to do business in this town and rent housing or apartments to people, it's going to be quality. And if they're not, then they're not welcome in Fresno. I think it's going to be that simple. And I think when a mayor carries that kind of message to its city manager and then the code enforcement director and their staff, people are going to get it. But I think the problem right now, and has been, is slumlords don't take City Hall serious. I think it's that simple.
There's a lot of perceptions out there of politics, of the way City Hall works, or maybe the way that City Hall worked at one time. And we hear from listeners all the time, and they send us letters and things. They say, you know, we want you to hold the politicians accountable. There's a perception out there that local politics is dominated by the development industry. And this goes back at least as far as Operation Rezone, maybe further. You were in office after that mess in the early to mid-90s. And that's back when a number of members of the city council were convicted of taking bribes from developers to rezone their land.
Mm-hmm.
Both you and your opponent have received significant contributions from the development industry. Lee, on the apartment owner's side, you've got some of the most prominent housing developers backing you. What would you say to those listeners or those people out there who have that perception that Fresno is run in some way by developers? Because that's not a new thing. We hear that all the time. Why are they wrong? Are they right? What do you say about that?
Well, first let me start with just money and why money is such an important part of an election or political process. It's because when we message, it costs money to put out, whether it's TV, radio, the flyers we put at a door. So then you go back to, where does the money come from? Which is why at the federal, state, local level, there are rules and regulations on how an elected official or someone running for office can access resources, and you have to follow rules. So, I mean, the mechanisms are there. I was surprised, honestly, at the Faith and Community Forum we had recently, where they had pie charts of where our monies were coming from. And one was from the development / business community, labor, and other groups. And I was pleasantly surprised that my pie chart was basically on kind of 25% all the way around, you know, because, you know, my sense was that, you know, most of my money was coming out of the business community, you know, and from the development community. But when I looked at Lee's chart, like 60% of his money was coming out of the development and the landlord type community. So,
and they're also including the Caglia contributions, yeah, and the, yeah, their, yeah, demolition,
yeah,
company in that.
Yeah. So, you know, I don't know. You know, when I look at that issue, I think you have to look at the person. You know, I think if someone is corruptible, it doesn't matter if it's a dollar or $1,000, you're corruptible. You know what I mean? So, you know, if you come in office with a good heart, and I mean, you're not always, you wish you could say you're going to, every decision was the best decision in the world, but you're going to make mistakes. But if you're coming from a good place and you're trying to make the best decision that you can, you know, at the end of the day, I think that's what we all want. I know people do have their suspicions about, oh my gosh, you know, this industry gave someone all their money, so is it going to influence their decision making? Well, I don't think.
You've accused your opponent of basically that, of his connections to the apartment industry.
Well, no, I have. And I have only because of the messaging that we have done and on the issue of slumlords. I mean, I can tell you, the association that represents those folks are not very happy with me right now because of what I've been saying. Because their philosophy is, hands off, leave us alone. And no, I mean, I know probably 80% of the housing stock, rental housing stock in this community is fine. And I don't support a plan of inspecting every rental unit in this community. I want to go after the slumlords. You know, that's where my focus is going to be. But it's not to say if some apartment in North Fresno is having a problem, that as a city, we're not going to help them too. To me, that's going to be a case-by-case basis. But I think the industry is saying hands off. So when I message and I say what I'm saying very clearly on how I am going to deal with slumlords day one, and Lee stands up and says, this is very hard, you know, and we have to really look at this, and that. And then at some point he'll say, and my association doesn't support this. I mean, well, yeah, that's why they're putting a lot of money behind this campaign. They want things and like things just the way they are. Well, I don't.
Before we go, the city's credit rating is improving. In the past, the city took on a lot of debt to fund everything from the exhibit hall expansion in the 90s to the stadium to the convention center renovations under Alan Autry to the No Neighborhood Left Behind program, which borrowed money.
$40 million.
To put new sidewalks and curbs in and older parts of town to the parks bond that helped do the BMX park at Woodward Park and the Southwest Sports Park. Some people say that debt was a major factor in the city's financial crisis. How open would you be, as things are improving, to looking at more debt in the future, new bonds, to fund some of the things that you've talked about?
Well, I mean, when you look at government, I mean, one of the major financing mechanisms for a city or a county or any municipality to grow is through creating debt. You know, you have to be smart and strategic about how you do it. But the mechanisms to do it are, bonds is one of them. So, yeah, no, I'd be open to that. I mean, we're going to have to do a combination of several things. One is taking a look at the $1 billion that you have right now as a city, and based on whatever the vision is between the mayor and city council and the community, where are you going to allocate those dollars? And there will be a reallocation of dollars. But then beyond that is, okay, if we do want to build whatever, how are you going to pay for it? Then it's going to come down to either asking the folks or taxpayers to pay more money or creating debt strategically to leverage something to be built. So, I mean, yeah, no, I think there'll be opportunities. And I think the city in the last 8 years was no different than the county of Fresno, you know, in terms of going through a recession. It's just, I think they panicked. They panicked when they went through their process, and as a result, they reduced public safety, they reduced their firefighting force, they cut their code enforcement half. They shouldn't be surprised at where they're at today. Not to say we didn't make tough decisions at the county. I mean, I was the chairman of the board at the time, and we saw the recession coming. But we were strategic when we said we're going to reduce our workforce by 1,000 employees through attrition. We're going to go into lower-tiered retirement plans. And once we got to the end, then we said, then we're going to work with all of our department heads. And I'll just use the sheriff as an example. I mean, she took cuts, but we were strategic. We said we
wanted... There's a lawsuit there also.
Well, that's the jail. That's the jail. That's... Yeah, that had nothing to do with the recession. But my point is, we knew we had to take cuts, but we were strategic in how and where we did it, with the goal of we're not going to cut public services to the point to where we're going to be harmful. And I think that's where the city made their mistake. They panicked, they made cuts, and they affected a lot of areas of their community.
How would you have dealt with that differently then? It seemed like the city had very limited options at that time. When it comes to trying to solve the mess they had, both with the decline in revenues, then you had all these other things going on, Granite Park and that. It was sort of a worst-case scenario. You're saying, I guess, reading between the lines, you wouldn't have cut public safety the way the mayor and council did. If they panicked, how would you not have panicked and approached it calmly?
Well, their problem, one, I believe, was not as big as they made it look, and the best visual that I'll give you is Measure G. If you remember how they tried to sell that to the community and saying, if we don't do this, we don't privatize this part of our workforce, we're not going to have the benefit of $3 million that it will generate for us, and we're going to have to lay off cops. Well, as a county supervisor, we oversee the treasury for every public entity in this county. And I can tell you, we could see the numbers for everybody. And we had $3 million sitting in our bank that was City of Fresno money at that time. That had they accepted it at the time, it would have taken away their argument that the world was ending with $3 million. So, I mean, I could probably spend another 2 hours talking to you about this. But I guess my point is, and why I say they panicked, is because they it wasn't as drastic as they were painting the picture. Was it drastic? Sure. Sure, we were all facing problems. I just think they made different choices without really understanding the full impact of the decisions they were making.
I don't want to end on a real arcane note, but one of those decisions was paying off internal loans that the city had borrowed from its internal funds. And there was a big debate back then. I remember Blong Zhang saying, I don't think we should do this. I want to keep these, pay this off later. I want to, you know, keep more employees. I want to keep public safety strong. And the mayor said, no, we need to pay this off because this is a bad way of doing your accounting as a city. Mm-hmm. Where are you on that issue of paying off these internal loans and borrowing from inner city departments like that?
Yeah. Well, that's another one of those discussions where you're both right. You know, and if you apply it back to your home, you know, if you're going to buy the TV, you know, do you just, you know, take money out of your savings and pay, you know, $1,000 for your TV, or do you buy it on credit? You know, neither one is right or wrong. They're both strategies. And I think they were both right in that. The mayor was right in that.
There's some question about whether it was legal.
Yeah, that's true, too. I mean, so the debt, there's no question, though, that debt had to be paid. The question was, do you pay it all today, or would you be strategic in maybe paying a quarter of it off this year, maybe a quarter next year? And when you make those different types of decisions, when they made the decision, we're going to pay it all off today, that's when you start cutting 150 cops. That's when you start cutting 25% of your firefighting workforce. So, I mean, that's all hindsight. It's all behind us. But do I agree that you need to minimize your debt to the extent that you can? Absolutely. And if there's more debt there, we need to continue that strategy to pay it off. But then the question is how and in what increments?
Fresno County Supervisor Henry Perea hopes to be the next mayor of Central California's largest city. He is scoring off against current City Council member Lee Brand in November. We thank him for joining us today.
Thank you. Appreciate the time.
And stay with us. There's more of Valley Edition's election special still to come as we begin our look at California's 17 ballot measures
and talk to Bakersfield mayoral candidate Karen Goh. That's all coming up in the next hour here on Valley Public Radio, KVPR Fresno, KPRX Bakersfield, online at kvpr.org.
This fall, a lot of campaigns are making big promises.
My fellow students, my campaign supports more recess every day.
Only time will tell how many will be kept.
Instead of math, we'll have video game class.
But there is one campaign that will keep its promise, to bring you insightful news and entertainment year-round. We call it Yes on 89. Join Valley Public Radio's fall membership campaign today at kvpr.org.
Have you ever heard an idea that changed the way you look at the world? That's what TED is all about. TED stands for Technology, Entertainment, and Design. It's a forum that brings together a wide range of creative thinkers and lets them make the case for a unique concept or cause. I'm Allison Stewart. Join me as we hear their TED Talks and then talk to them on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Sunday afternoon at 4 on Valley Public Radio.
Listening to a special two-hour Valley Edition election preview. I'm Joe Moore. We're with you until 11 a.m. this morning as we begin our look at California's ballot measures. At first glance, Proposition 53 on California's November ballot could bore you to tears. It's about revenue bonds. But its outcome could throw a roadblock in front of the state's plans to build a high-speed rail system or its biggest water project in decades. It's pitting taxpayer groups and an angry Delta farmer against some business, environmental, and labor groups. As part of our California Counts election coverage, Capital Public Radio's Amy Quinton brings us this report.
Let's say California wants to build a big bridge, dam, or train system. The state borrows money to pay for it by selling bonds to investors. There are two kinds of bonds it can sell. General obligation bonds are repaid with interest from the state's general fund. That's taxpayers' money and requires voter approval. But revenue bonds don't. That's because users of the project pay the bonds back through revenues like bridge tolls. Proposition 53 would change that.
It simply requires that any revenue bonds issued by the state of California in excess of $2 billion be approved by the voters. That's all it does.
That's Prop 53 supporter John Kupal with the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association. He says the measure is really about preventing too much state debt. He wants to stop the state from building big projects with murky financing, or at least give voters a chance to decide.
When you get into the area of these mega projects, like high-speed rail, like the Twin Tunnels, then the financing scheme becomes more and more speculative.
He's talking about two expensive and controversial projects backed by California Governor Jerry Brown, the $68 billion high-speed rail system and the $15 billion Twin Tunnels that would carry water from the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta to Central and Southern California. Under Prop 53, both would require voter approval. But the nonpartisan legislative analyst's office says it's unclear which other projects would be affected. And that's exactly what worries opponents. Lauren Kay is with the California Chamber of Commerce.
Prop 53 would affect projects all around the state, from north to south. It would affect state projects. It would affect local projects. It's deceptive, sponsored by a single farmer in the Delta who has a problem with a particular project in the Delta.
That man is Dino Cortopassi, a Delta farmer who has been outspoken against the tunnel project. Prop 53 was his idea, and he and his family spent more than $4 million to get the measure on the ballot.
I'm not opposed to generating more water for California, for goodness sakes. I'm opposed to damn boondoggles like this that are nothing more than a way to spend public money.
Governor Brown has just put $1.7 million into the campaign to defeat Prop 53. Many business, environmental, and labor groups oppose it too. Lauren Kay says they fear the measure would undermine local control and put projects on hold.
If you want to improve the toll bridges in the Bay Area, which are financed by revenue bonds, you'd give voters in Los Angeles and San Diego the ability to approve or turn down those proposals, even though they may never drive on those toll roads.
Prop 53 has been called one of the most complex and unsexy initiatives on the ballot, but likely one of the most important. Because it's so broadly written, if it passes, it could end up in court. In Sacramento, I'm Amy Quinton.
And joining us now on Valley Edition to talk about Prop 53 and a number of the other ballot measures before voters in November, we have with us Fresno State political science professor Thomas Holyoke, who joins us now in our studio. Tom, welcome.
Hello, Joe.
Prop 53, an unsexy ballot measure, but broadly written. Boy, does that not summarize what is in front of voters in many cases in 2016 here. This issue of something being broadly written and opening up legal challenges, is that increasingly what we're seeing in many of these cases?
There have been a number of propositions that have this kind of weakness in them. Badly written propositions that, you know, they're so broad that it's so undefined that they almost beg for, you know, a challenge in the court systems. And it's also, of course, extremely confusing to voters, because when you have a very broadly, almost vaguely written proposition, you know, voters become a little unsure as to what exactly they're voting for. And if the voter can't make an informed decision, then how can the voters exercise the prerogatives under direct democracy?
And it's also interesting in this case, Dino Cotrapassi, the Delta farmer who's a big opponent of the governor's plan to route Delta flows under, a big opponent of the effort by Governor Brown to route Sacramento River flows underneath the Delta and deliver them to Southern California and the Valley. He is bankrolling this, but he's not unique in this election. There are other big personal interests who are backing many of these propositions. Are we increasingly seeing that as well?
We have been for a number of years now, seeing particularly wealthy individuals almost single-handedly bankroll several kinds of initiatives. And that's a huge concern. And I think actually Prop 53 is a good example of this, because when you have a single individual bankrolling a proposition, it's almost certainly something that benefits that individual or stops something that the individual personally wants stopped. And in this particular proposition, a lot of Valley voters need to be awfully careful about this. There's an awful lot of people out there, and with some justification, we should say that the Twin Tunnels project is actually, there's a lot of potential benefit for the Valley in terms of ensuring a water supply for farmers, especially farmers over on the western side of the Valley. So while something like Prop 53 sounds like, oh, yeah, well, it's the state should always approve all these revenue bonds and everything, anything that undermines a project like the Twin Tunnels could actually have some pretty detrimental effects. And it's all being bankrolled by a Delta farmer, and Delta farmers individually feel very, very threatened by this proposal.
Let's move on to another issue. We aren't going to get to all of them today, but that'll be for our next program as well.
Not with this many.
Only 16 to go, Tom. I want to go to another bond one this time, and this is Proposition 51. This would put aside $9 billion in bonds for education and schools. A lot of local districts are looking at this throughout the Valley as a revenue match for their school bonds, many of which are also on the ballot this fall. How is this going to tie in with those local measures?
Well, it helps tie in with the local measures because it raises, you know, additional money than for school building. And in some cases, school districts are issuing bonds that have, I believe, matching fund criteria. So they're kind of depending on the state to pony up some of the money. This is an odd one in the sense that the governor has come out, I believe, very much against this. You know, Governor Brown's been trying to greatly reduce the state's debt. And the state of California is carrying an awful lot of debt from many, many years worth of bond issues. And the governor's made a big deal in his time in office about trying to drive that debt down. And so he sees this as, you know, opening up the floodgates again, you know, issuing a lot of money, taking on a lot of debt, undoing all the work that he has done. So this has become rather controversial in that sense. On the other hand, it's a proposal that tends to be very popular. It's supportive of education. Everyone wants to be supportive of education. Most everyone wants to be supportive of education. But on the other hand, California already does have, as Governor Brown would describe it, a crushing wall of debt. We need to be careful before adding to it.
If that fails, but local bond measures succeed, but those local bond measures need the match from the state, what happens then?
Well, it depends on the way the local bond measure is written. If a local bond measure is written in such a way that it is contingent on the state measure passing, then the local bond measures would, you know, by default go down. Not all of them necessarily are written that way. It would simply be less money available. But again, it depends on what individual districts are doing.
So again, that's Proposition 51, $9 billion in new bonds for education and school construction in California. In many cases, it could be matched by local districts. Moving on, also related to revenue, also related to education, this is Proposition 55. This would extend at least some of the income tax increases that were approved by voters in a temporary way back under Prop 1A. This is for people who have an annual income of over $250,000. Again, this was supposed to be a temporary thing, but as we know in Sacramento, temporary doesn't always mean that.
And, you know, back when Proposition 1A was passed, the people who were against the measure actually said that. It says temporary, but in California, temporary tax increases have a habit of turning into permanent tax increases. And now it looks like that they may be proven right. You know, this was originally passed back when we were still in the Great Recession, and California state revenues were way, way down. And that was hurting an awful lot of institutions, including the university system and even to some extent the K-12 education system. So Proposition 1A was passed, as I recall, with a heavy emphasis on let's save education in the state. The state's finances, to a large extent, have bounced back, but with the continuation of, well, basically taking the temporary tax increase and making it essentially permanent, probably, that's going to try to ensure a much higher level of revenue. But I believe it goes into the general funds as opposed to something dedicated to education. And of course, there's the concern that this is a tax that is designed really to hit the wealthiest people in California. And there's always that concern that if we extend taxes on the wealthy, that will drive, you know, wealthier people out of California.
We'll see what happens there when voters weigh in again on Proposition 55. That's extension of income tax increases previously approved by voters under Proposition 1A for people who make over $250,000 a year. Speaking of education, jumping now to Prop 58, this also is voters weighing in on a subject they weighed in on over a decade ago, almost two decades ago in this case, and it's about bilingual education in public schools. Now, I remember when voters weighed in on this, it was Prop 227 in 1998. Voters outlawed this. Now they're being asked to essentially reverse it?
Essentially, yes. Back in 1998, there was a concern about what this was doing to the integration of schools and really the assimilation of people coming into the United States. The idea was that if you promote bilingual education, then people coming in from south of the border were not having a proper incentive. It was believed to learn English and assimilate. This concern, to some extent, has flown in the face of evidence that shows that bilingual education actually does benefit learning. And so now with the dynamics and politics of the state have changed a great deal. There's a lot more people who are Latino who are now in more influential positions, and there's an interest in overturning that ban now. And of course, this gets caught up in the larger immigration debate that has dominated politics this year, even way up to the national level. But in California, where we're probably going to have an enhanced Latino turnout, one, because there's a lot more Latinos registered to vote in California, and also because, Donald Trump on the ballot has pushed a lot of Latinos to register to vote. And we expect that a good number of them will also vote to bring bilingual education back to the state.
Is this unusual that voters would be asked to essentially have a new vote on a proposition that they weighed in on less than 20 years ago?
Well, it's not unheard of. But really, if you're going to try to overturn, the bilingual education ban, then you can't really do it through the state legislature. It would have to be done this way. So it's not unheard of, but it isn't the most common kind of ballot measure, I would say.
One other uncommon ballot measure that, prompted a lawsuit even before it made it to the ballot is Proposition 59. This is about campaign finance, but it's not a bond. It's not a constitutional amendment. It's a state position on Citizens United versus the Federal Election Commission. This is the Supreme Court ruling from a few years back that opened the door to so-called dark money in politics, super PACs, and those sorts of things where donors are not disclosed. Why is this on the ballot, and what's significant about it?
Well, this is one that I personally feel rather strongly about. My own specialty as a practicing political scientist, as I study interest groups and the movement of money in political campaigns. And dark money has become one of the most really seriously concerning things that have arisen in American politics in the last few years. I mean, overall, campaign spending has just rocketed up until we're talking about billions of dollars being spent in campaigns across the United States. It's bad enough that, the amounts are so high, but we're in a situation now where an awful lot of money is moving without being seen. That is, it's easier to sort of see where organizations are spending their money when it comes to, investing in political campaigns. It's a lot harder to figure out where organizations are getting their money from, who is donating to campaign organizations. The Supreme Court's decision in Citizens United versus the Federal Election Commission was a big part of this. It wasn't the only court case, but it's one of the pivotal ones, and certainly the one that's best known, where the Supreme Court has essentially declared that contributing money for politics is freedom of speech. It's protected under the First Amendment, which I find a little hard to fathom, but the court didn't ask me. There is an effort underway in the United States to essentially pass a constitutional amendment to forbid spending to be considered as protected by the First Amendment. Because since the Supreme Court says it is protected by the First Amendment, there really is almost no other way, except even changing the composition of the court might not change that. So this is an effort to overturn a court decision by actually amending the Constitution. And this would basically, as I understand it, commit California to supporting a constitutional amendment should one become possible.
Man, but there was some legal question as to whether this is the sort of thing that could even wind up on the ballot, correct?
There was something about that. I mean, what are we actually doing here? Committing in California to a possible position under the right sort of circumstance. That's a pretty murky thing to be doing.
Is this like the city council passing a resolution on something rather than an actual ordinance?
Well, it's not even quite like that. A resolution is simply, well, this is an ideal world. This is what we would see. As I understand this proposition, it would actually be committing California to a position should the Congress of the United States actually authorize an amendment to the Constitution. So it's trying to bind California to take a particular kind of action without knowing whether that action will be ever actually have a chance to happen in the future. It's really kind of a peculiar thing, but other states are doing it too.
We will watch and see what happens with that one again. It's Proposition 59 about the state's official, quote-unquote, position on Citizens United versus the Federal Election Commission campaign finance reform. Want to look at some other ones now. As you've just joined us, we're talking about California's ballot measures with Fresno State political scientist Dr. Thomas Holyoke. One that has hit home locally, and a local story about this was really in the statewide news about a month ago, and that's Proposition 57. Governor Brown and Fresno County Sheriff Margaret Mims traded some barbs about this one, including a tersely worded voicemail that the governor left for Sheriff Mims, who sponsored a mailing that suggested that certain convicts in state prison, including one in the case of this mailer who had been convicted of a crime of rape, would be eligible for release under Prop 57, eligible for early release. This is, a part of an ongoing push by Governor Brown and others in Sacramento on criminal justice reform. How is this different than the other ones we've seen, Prop 47, others, and what is the sticking point here?
Well, as you know, the governor has been under enormous pressure, and some of it court-ordered pressure, to get the California prison system to essentially reduce the inmate load. And, you know, there's a variety of ways of doing that. You know, early release, the reclassification of, you know, sentencing. The concern that people like Sheriff Mims have expressed is that essentially we are putting ourselves in a position where potentially, you know, convicts are being released who may continue to be violent, people who are not sufficiently rehabilitated and may, you know, return to the communities and continue to commit crimes. And so the sheriff has felt very strongly about this and, you know, rises in property-related crime. She points to is, you know, this is because the governor's already been releasing a lot of people, that this has caused a risen in property crime. And she's afraid that it's going to get, you know, that much worse and she doesn't have the resources to deal with it. And because Sheriff Mims has been very outspoken on this, yes, she got into that little war of words, or at least war of answering machines with the governor.
If the sheriff and the governor and other criminal justice experts themselves looking at this proposition cannot at this point come to some sort of understanding about how this would be interpreted, how is the voter supposed to do that? Because the sheriff is saying, well, it's up to the governor's office. He's saying they would issue regulations that would mean these people would not be getting out, but that's not actually in the ballot measure. If we're getting that far down into the minutiae of something, how is the average voter supposed to make up their mind on something like this?
It's problematic. In fact, this is not the only ballot measure that suffers from this trust me problem. And this happens actually with quite a number of ballot measures. You know, the ballot measure talks in broad generalities. You don't know how it's going to be implemented. I know there's some concern about that with also with the, you know, the state financing bonds, with the, you know, Fresno Unified's bond proposal that's going forward. You know, a lot of things. It does put the voter in a very difficult position because the voter has really no idea what the impact of this is going to be, because devil's in the details, and we have no idea what the details are going to be. So it becomes virtually impossible for the voter to make an informed decision. And that's problematic because the whole notion of direct democracy depends on voters having the information to make an informed decision.
There are a lot of ballot measures, 17 of them on the ballot in November, but a few of them, a few topics actually have two ballot measures, one on one side and one on the other. Let's start out with plastic bags. It's a little less heavy than the death penalty one, which we'll get to in a moment. But plastic bags, there's Proposition 67, which is a prohibition on plastic single-use carry-out bags. And then another proposition, and that one is Proposition 65, grocery and retail carry-out bags. The plastic manufacturer industry is backing one. The grocery industry is backing one. And one is actually a referendum. Let's take the referendum first, because that overturns the existing state law. What is the state of things today? Because I thought the legislature passed this thing, but last I saw, I was still getting plastic bags at the grocery store.
Yes, me too. Yes, the legislature did pass a law to essentially require the grocery business to phase out plastic bags. The grocery business, and to an extent the plastic bag business, even more so them, you know, opposed this. It became known that they were going to, you know, file a referendum on the ballot, and consequently the legislation banning plastic bags was essentially suspended. And so proponents of the plastic bag ban also decided to come to the ballot with their own measure. I mean, this is basically, this is such a California thing, banning plastic bags.
Is this what Hiram Johnson envisioned?
I mean, you know, when I talked about this with people in other states, they just look at me as like, only California would do that. And maybe Oregon. But on the other hand, you know, I've been hearing an awful lot of people complain about how filthy the land along the highways is, just full of plastic bags everywhere. And you've heard concerns expressed about lots of plastic bags ending up in the ocean. that plastic bags kill turtles, that there's those whole, you know, giant pools out there full of plastic bags. Plastic bags do not degrade easily, so they last a very long time. In other words, they're environmentally destructive. And what's one of the biggest places we get plastic bags? Well, it's at the grocery store. And so, you know, the effort here is to try to cut down on the number of plastic bags by essentially, you know, eliminating this, one of the biggest sources of plastic bags where most individuals get their plastic bags.
Moving on to the other two propositions dealing with one issue, and that involves the death penalty. Proposition 62 is to repeal the death penalty as it currently exists in California. And Proposition 66 is on the other side. What's exactly going on here with these two? Is it this that simple as yes or no, or is there more complexity to this?
Well, it basically comes down to, is California going to have a death penalty or not? We do have one right now. It's, you know, it's not exactly used a lot, but there's an awful lot of people in California for a number of reasons think that the death penalty needs to be gotten rid of. It may be concerns that we are, you know, executing, you know, people who have not been clearly proven guilty, who may actually be innocent. It's concern over the methods of execution, that they are not properly humane. Concerns that, you know, execution hits particular, you know, demographic groups a lot harder than some others, and for, you know, for a variety of reasons. People have made the case that we should do away with the death penalty in California. It also tends to be extremely expensive. And interestingly enough, other states are getting rid of their death penalty simply because of the sheer cost of it. My home state of Nebraska actually did this recently. They got rid of their death penalty, but in a case not unlike California's, there's a proposition on their ballot to reinstate it. Because there's also a lot of people who feel that the death penalty is actually a deterrent. That without the death penalty out there, people might be more inclined to commit violent crime. But knowing that they might be executed for it, well, then maybe they would be less inclined to do it. I'm not sure there's a lot of evidence that actually backs that up. But a lot of people do seem to believe that. So, yeah, consequently, when it became clear there was going to be a ballot effort to eliminate the death penalty, well, proponents of the death penalty essentially went to the ballot to push back with their own ballot measure, essentially guaranteeing that we will continue to have a death penalty, although trying to make it, you know, be implemented in a more humane manner.
We're talking about California's ballot measures today on Valley Public Radio. Fresno State political science professor Thomas Holyoke with us today. One that is probably maybe the marquee one of the entire race, or at least it's been getting perhaps the most discussion, that's Proposition 64, the legalization of recreational marijuana and hemp in California. California used to be a leader, maybe perhaps the one state that was the bellwether for others across the nation, but Colorado, Oregon, other states have already done this. Will California voters approve this November, Professor Holyoke?
I would be astonished if they did not. In fact, I was mildly surprised that a few years ago when this ballot measure was there that California did not approve it. And I think there's probably a lot of Californians out there who feel mildly embarrassed that, you know, Colorado beat them to the punch on this. On the other hand, this is still actually illegal under federal law. So it puts California in a bit of a gray area. And right now, the Obama administration is basically decided to turn a blind eye to what states like, you know, Colorado and Washington have done on this. And if Hillary Clinton wins the presidency, she may also have her Department of Justice just sort of ignore this. But, you know, another administration could have a very different take on this. So it's a bit of a gray area. In fact, as I understand, in states like Colorado, when you go into a pot dispensary to make a purchase, you almost have to pay in cash because the federal banking system won't allow credit cards and checks to be used.
Very interesting. A brave new world that we're in. We'll see what voters weigh in on that issue of legalization of recreational marijuana. Again, Proposition 64. Looking at some other ones, on the far less sexy note is Proposition 54. This is about a practice that has been used in Sacramento for some time, usually at the end of the legislative session, where a bill that's about forestry practices is all of a sudden, the text is deleted and is replaced with a new text about something entirely different. They call it gut and amend. Why is this significant, and is this an important step in governance for California?
Actually, I think this is a good step in the right direction for a more transparent government. What happens in Sacramento at the end of the legislative session, deals are getting cut, sometimes some really big deals regarding the budget or other big ticket issues. And the deals get made at the last minute. They're up against the legislative deadline. They need to get something moved. But generally, bills are supposed to be available for 3 days before they're passed. So to get around this, what they do is they take a bill that's been sitting out there for a while, strike out all its text, put in the new text, which is on a completely different subject, not germane to the old bill. But because the shell of the bill has been sitting out there for several days now, it all of a sudden meets the legal requirement and can be passed. The big problem with this is that it means legislators are being required to vote on bills that they know next to nothing about. Often, they don't even get to see the text of the bill after one of these guts and amends. They don't get to see the text of the bill before they're voting on it. Or maybe they've seen the text of the bill 5 minutes before they're being asked to cast a vote on this. And again, the legislative leadership can say, trust me that this is a good bill, but how would you know? So legislators are casting uninformed votes. That means we, the people, are not being particularly well represented. And of course, the people have no idea, no ability to inspect the bills for themselves before, trying to instruct their legislators on what they should do.
We're quickly running out of time. I'm not sure we're going to be able to get to all of these, but one last one that is before voters is Proposition 63. This is backed by Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom and his efforts to tighten gun control in California. Background checks for ammunition purchases. Right now, you don't need them. If this passes, you will. A hot button issue amongst Second Amendment advocates.
Mm. Well, this is... I mean, this is the kind of proposal. So it's sort of the equivalent of, taking a stick and hitting a wasp's nest. It resonates with a large portion of the Democratic base, the idea of stricter gun control. And it's being proposed by a man who almost certainly wishes to be a governor of the state of California. So while it probably would actually create some meaningful restrictions, I still have to believe that this is really about Gavin Newsom promoting himself, positioning himself for running for governor to replace Jerry Brown.
You don't think it would be an effective tool?
Oh, I think it has some potential to be effective, but I just don't think that's the primary motivation here. And of course, there's every chance that this is going to end up in the courts. Anytime you're dealing with, any kind of potential limit on gun rights, that's the sort of thing that gun rights advocates are going to immediately take to the court and ask the federal courts to strike down as contrary to the Second Amendment. Whether this particular proposal can pass constitutional muster, I don't know. That's something the courts would have to decide. But I think this is an issue that resonates well with a lot of Democratic voters, and that's who Gavin Newsom is really trying to play to as he positions himself to run for governor.
You can find analysis on these ballot measures and others on our website at kvpr.org. Again, good luck to all the voters trying to weigh these issues in November. Fresno State Professor Thomas Holyoke from the Political Science Department joining us today. Thank you so much, Tom.
My pleasure.
This is a Valley Edition two-hour election special. I'm Joe Moore. Bakersfield will soon have a new mayor for the first time in over a decade. Karen Goh and Kyle Carter are facing off on the November ballot for the chance to lead Kern County's largest city. The Bakersfield mayor's race is a little different than the one in Fresno, specifically because Bakersfield doesn't enjoy a strong mayor form of government. Basically, the city manager runs the show in Bakersfield. But still, the office of mayor carries a lot of clout. In addition to running city council meetings and casting a vote if there's a tie, the mayor is a figurehead for the city, someone who can champion causes and cut ribbons, and if they're effective, unite the community. Next week, we'll hear from Carter. Today, we hear from Karen Goh, currently the CEO of the nonprofit group Garden Pathways and a former Kern County supervisor. Yesterday, we had a chance to talk over the phone. Here's what she had to say about her vision for Bakersfield. Karen, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Karen, there are a lot of issues right now in Kern County and in the city of Bakersfield. And I want to get your thoughts on some of them, starting out with law and order and public safety and the Bakersfield Police Department. It's been in the news a lot lately, some of that attention negative. How confident are you in the state of the department today, given the recent convictions of Patrick Mara and Damasio Diaz? And do you think the city should take seriously those allegations that Diaz leveled, saying that corruption goes beyond just those two rogue officers, as Chief Williamson described it, and that it extends through the department? Should we take that seriously, and what do you think of the state of the department today?
I'm so thankful for the law enforcement officers who serve faithfully and give of their lives for our community to protect our public safety. It's unfortunate when there are individuals who choose not to do the right thing. And certainly, these kinds of allegations should be researched and taken seriously. I am confident that the leadership of the Bakersfield Police Department seeks to do the right thing and to operate with integrity, to operate at the very highest levels. And so I'm confident that they will want to make sure that everyone on the police department is doing what they're supposed to be doing for the safety and benefit of our community.
Now, it came out last week, City Manager Alan Tandy indicated, and a review of the city's charter backs this up, that the city's charter, again, this is essentially the constitution of the city of Bakersfield, requires that the selection of a new police chief come from within the ranks of the department, essentially as an internal promotion. And this, of course, is an issue now because of the vacancy that is soon to come with the impending retirement of Chief Greg Williamson. Do you think that's something that voters should look at, that this might be something that should be reopened at some point, looking at the city's charter on that issue? Or are you happy with the internal promote from within approach?
You know, there are benefits to promoting within with experience. Certainly, if the voters choose to have the charter reexamined, that would be the choice of the voters. But again, I'm confident that the leadership of the Bakersfield City Department, Police Department, wants to do the right thing. And they are going to make every effort to investigate whatever outside help might be available. I am confident that our leadership seeks to do the right thing. And because there are some individuals who have chosen to go against the standards, that does not put the entire department into question.
We're talking with Bakersfield mayoral candidate Karen Goh right now on Valley Edition, looking at a number of issues that are before the city on a variety of fronts. One of them that often pops up, not just in Bakersfield, but throughout California, is the, in some cases, cooperation, but in some cases, competition between county government and city government. There have been a lot of instances where this has reared its head in Kern County and in Bakersfield in particular. One that maybe is less government focused, but more just the business world, is development and things like that. You have the Tejon Ranch Company that's doing so many things on their property at the very southern tip of the valley. The distribution centers there have been a big happening in recent years. You have the new outlet center that is attracting retailers there. You also have plans for the new Grapevine Village community. How do you feel that those sorts of developments, are those a good thing for the city of Bakersfield, or do those have potential to take sales tax dollars away or other development projects? Why not build that distribution center in the city of Bakersfield instead of at Tejon Ranch? How do you view that issue of competition? Do you see that as a concern if you were mayor?
Cooperation is a wonderful thing. And instead of looking at unhealthy competition, I think we need to be focused on what is the best thing for the citizens of Bakersfield and the citizens of Kern County. And as former county supervisor of the 5th District and now looking for a position within the city, I can only see us working together to achieve the end results that are positive. And so the developments in Tejon are positive for our community because there are residents who live in the city who are getting jobs out there. As mayor, I certainly would want to extend cooperation that goes beyond just thinking about the city of Bakersfield. Because in the end, as we work together on economic development, job growth, and business development, we're only going to achieve better results if we truly have the interests of our community in mind instead of serving interests of territorialism.
One other issue that's very different but actually is somewhat related, it just popped up last month or last few weeks ago, and that's involving food truck regulation in the city of Bakersfield. The city council passed new regulations there, establishing new rules, but also saying where these food trucks can operate, making sure they aren't too close to public parks and things like that, but also that they aren't too close to established restaurants and other things. Some people say that's the city favoring one business type over another. Where do you line up philosophically on something like that? Food trucks are very popular in many cities across the country, including growing popularity in Bakersfield. What do you think about these new regulations? Good, bad, or indifferent?
Our community has been very enthusiastic about food trucks. I've heard from so many people how delighted they are to have multiple choices now. In terms of location, the wonderful thing about the way our government works is that the public gets input, and we had people come before the city council to give input to the ordinances. And so while I believe that certainly the food trucks are a wonderful thing, we also have to keep in mind the existing businesses. So as with so many things, balance in the way we approach our issues is so important. But I believe in this case, we're listening to the voice of our community. And as things develop in the future, maybe there is further input, I think those things will be considered. But for right now, the ordinance that the city passed is in keeping with what was heard by the public.
I'm
so grateful. I'm really, really grateful for having greater choices here. I lived in an urban community some years ago and had the delight of many food choices. And as we grow as a community in diversity, in having additional populations come here, they're looking for amenities such as great restaurants and great alternate means of food. So just really thankful that we have people who are willing to establish their businesses here and provide us with new opportunities.
One type of business that is controversial, and in some cases it's quite possible it could be even more controversial in the future, is this issue of marijuana dispensaries. It's going before voters in California in November on the same ballot as the Bakersfield mayor's race. It remains to be seen what California voters say there, although many political observers expect initiative to pass legalizing, at least in state law, the recreational use of marijuana. City of Bakersfield had a really interesting history in marijuana ordinances for medical marijuana dispensaries. What would you like to see the city do when it comes to regulating these sorts of businesses in the city of Bakersfield, both medical and recreational, moving forward?
The voters are going to make a choice on recreational use. In terms of medical marijuana, I was on the Board of Supervisors when we had to make some difficult decisions about medical marijuana dispensaries. And my focus is always what's in the best interest of the public, what's in the best interest of our children. And I still believe that it is okay, but we want to make medical marijuana available to those who truly, truly need it and would benefit from it through appropriate means. However, at the same time, we want to keep our children safe. We want to keep our community safe. And so I'm still in favor of any dispensaries that we would have to be in remote industrial areas of the county, far away from churches and schools and parks and daycares.
Karen Goh with us today on Valley Edition. So I take it you're saying that you don't want them in the city. If they're in the county, you would be okay with that, but with those conditions. Is that my understanding of what you're saying?
if people who need medical marijuana and can get it in an appropriate fashion are able to obtain it within our county, I feel that that would give them the opportunity. So, yes, I do not want to have them in proximity with churches, with schools, with parks and daycare. So putting them in an appropriate place that is still accessible to those who need medical marijuana is what I would be in favor of.
Karen Goh is with us today on Valley Edition, running for mayor of Bakersfield. The drought is ongoing. The state recently lifted its mandatory conservation guidelines. City of Bakersfield runs its own water system. Also, some residents rely on Cal Water. When it comes to the city's water policies, you know, there's been a lot of talk. Let's put that water back down the river back when we have a flood year like it was in, I guess it was 2011. There's talk about reopening the splash parks, making sure those stay open in the future. What do you think the city should be doing when it comes to advancing water policy and making sure that residents have a reliable supply and also a supply they can afford?
We need to continue to educate our public to be responsible in conserving. At the same time, though, what we really need to do is to continue to fight for our appropriate share of water in our community. And right now, Bakersfield and Kern County is not getting its proportionate share of water. And so I do believe that as a community, we really have to continue that fight. We already have had that fight, but it's ongoing, and we have to continue to intensify that to turn on the water from north and to get the water that our farmers and our communities so desperately need.
What do you think the city could do to improve that situation?
What I believe in terms of the city is those of us who are leaders have to continue to support those who are able to advocate for our fair allocation for the industry that grows food for California. The city also certainly can encourage conservation, and we can be responsible in what we're able to do on a local level. But the amount of water that we would save as a community is so minuscule to the amount of water that we really need. It's not to say that we shouldn't be conserving that water, but at the same time, what we really, really need is to get the water that we need from our state. And that really has to continue to be a priority for our city and for our community.
Karen Goh with us today, talking about a variety of issues in the Bakersfield mayor's race. One of the things that always pops up every few years is downtown revitalization efforts. The city has a large investment downtown, both in city infrastructure, also investments in even things like the Padre Hotel, which brought a new nightlife and other opportunities to the city. The redevelopment agency is gone, so that's not there anymore. The governor did away with those. That was used in many cases to support those sorts of projects. What would you like to see the city do when it comes to trying to breathe more life and new life into downtown?
Economic development and job creation is my priority, as are safe and clean neighborhoods and the opportunities that education will bring for our young people. And so for downtown, which is has so much potential to be developed, we will continue to focus on that economic development in developing private partnerships, public-private partnerships, encouraging people to come to our community, which is so wonderful. We really have so many wonderful advantages in our community with our resources, with our hardworking workforce, that there are opportunities for development here. I'm grateful for the investment that's been made already in downtown in the Arts District, particularly with the Padre, as you had mentioned, and then at 19th and I to see the Arts District develop. I'm part of a new board that's developed down there focusing on the arts. And ongoing collaboration with downtown. Another aspect is to make sure that downtown is clean and safe so that we can continue to attract people to come down here. My nonprofit, Garden Pathways, over which I am president, has a joint initiative with the Bakersfield Homeless Center and the Mission at Kern County, and then with Garden Pathways, where we have street ambassadors going out to clean the streets to connect those who are homeless to the appropriate services so that we can have a safe and clean downtown. And it's as we're all continuing to work on initiatives such as that, to continue to make connections to those who might be interested in coming downtown and actively connect with them, that we will see that growth in our downtown. I'm really excited about what we have to offer in our downtown. You know, we have these fantastic selling points in Kern County. It's the fastest growing economy in the U.S. since 2001. The cost of doing business is 93% of the U.S. average. And as I mentioned earlier, we're in an ideal location. It's a four-hour drive to 90% of our state's population and 38 million customers. So for us to have a thriving downtown is something that we're looking forward to, something to which I am very much committed. I live in downtown. Our business is downtown with Garden Pathways, our nonprofit, and that is a primary focus of mine, as it is for many in our community.
Before we go, one of those things that you just mentioned, all those great things about the economy and growth in Kern County, certainly highlights for the community. When it comes to boosting Bakersfield's image, what would you do? Bakersfield is not unlike other places in the interior of California, whether it's the Inland Empire or the Central Valley, that we often hear, you know, the media from outside, from L.A. or San Francisco or New York, make fun of places like Bakersfield. What would you do as mayor to try to change that dialogue? How would you improve the city's image?
I would have a twofold job that already has begun. So one is to get our residents to express that pride in our city and not be pulled down and have their heads hang low. But using technology to make sure that those both within our community and those outside our community are aware of our wonderful, wonderful community and the many, many benefits of our community, the things that people talk about all the time, and the opportunity here. So I've already started conversations with people in technology to find a better way to communicate that on the outside. I have always had conversations with Kern Economic Development Corporation and with the city, people who highlight the good of our city, and I'm going to continue those conversations and keep encouraging a very positive direction. While I was on the County Board of Supervisors, I did that, and that's something that I'm going to continue to do to make sure that people know how great our community is. And I truly believe that greater things are yet to come in this city, and I look forward to working together with people on economic development and job growth, safe and clean and affordable neighborhoods, and then also for those opportunities that education will bring for our young people through vocational training and through apprenticeships. And I really see a city that's teeming with commerce, with production, with clean and safe neighborhoods, a thriving arts district, a thriving business district, a wonderful downtown, all supported by responsible and efficient city government.
Karen Goh is a candidate for mayor of Bakersfield on the November ballot. She joins us today on Valley Edition. Karen, thanks so much for taking the time.
And thank you so much. I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, that's all for Valley Edition's two-hour election preview show. I'm Joe Moore. Join us next week. We'll hear from Fresno mayoral candidate Lee Brand and Bakersfield mayoral candidate Kyle Carter. We'll also talk about the rest of the ballot measures and some other local measures that are going before voters in the fall and more. That's next week on our program, our last one before Election Day. For Valley Edition producer and reporter Ezra David Romero, reporters Jeffrey Hess and Carrie Klein, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, dedicated to a healthcare system that works for all Californians, on the web at chcf.org.